This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Nicholas Farkas? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Nicholas James Farkas was born on February 25, 1983, and lived in St. Paul, Minnesota. He went by the name Nick. He married a woman named Heidi. She was almost 2 years younger than he was. The couple was very active in their church. They were viewed as leaders there. Nick made a living by installing carpets as part of his family's business. In August 2007, Nick and Heidi purchased a house on the 1700 block of West Minnehaha Avenue. Many people viewed the couple as being in love and having fun, but there was no laughter at that address, not even a Minnehaha. The couple had financed the $215,000 purchase price with two mortgages. The total payment was about $1,550 a month, which was well beyond their means. The last mortgage payment they made was in September 2008. In April 2009, Nick was served with foreclosure documents. In June 2009, the house was sold at a sheriff's auction. On February 12, 2010, eviction proceedings were filed. The same day, Nick and Heidi departed Minnesota for a five-day vacation to Hawaii. The trip cost over $3,500. On March 8, 2010, Nick attended the eviction hearing by himself. Heidi was not there. He agreed to vacate the premises by March 22, but he did not keep his promise. On April 6, Nick contacted the law firm handling the foreclosure and told them that his grandmother was in hospice and would soon be dead. He wanted a couple of extra weeks to move out. The law firm agreed and rescheduled the lockout date to April 26, 2010. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On Sunday, April 25, 2010, one day before Nick and Heidi were to be evicted, an incident occurred at their house. At 6:31 a.m., Heidi's cell phone was used to place two hang-up calls to 911. At 6:32 a.m., Heidi called 911 and spoke to an operator. She indicated that someone was trying to break into her house. 38 seconds into that call, as Heidi was giving the operator her address, a noise can be heard in the background. It sounded like a gunshot. Heidi stopped speaking, and the call went dead. At 6:33 a.m., Nick Farkas called 911 using Heidi's cell phone. He claimed that an intruder had broken into his house. He and his wife had been shot as they were trying to escape to the garage out of the back of the house. This call lasted almost 7 minutes. Near the end of the call, the police can be heard entering the house. Police officers noticed that the front door was open about 1 inch. There was a double-barrel shotgun on the floor near the front door. Heidi Farkas was on her back in the kitchen, almost 15 feet from the front door. She had been killed by one shotgun blast to the back. Nick Farkas was next to her on the phone with the 911 operator. He had a gunshot wound to his upper left leg. Before Nick was taken to the hospital, he told the police that one or maybe two people broke into his house. He had retrieved his shotgun. He and his wife were trying to escape to the detached garage when one of the intruders grabbed the shotgun from him. The intruder shot him and his wife. Nick was released from the hospital about 3 hours after arriving. The wound to his leg was not severe. Nick gave investigators a more detailed statement at the police station. Here's what he said. Nick woke up at about 6:10 or 6:15 a.m. He heard the screen door open and somebody manipulating the doorknob of the front door. Nick retrieved a double-barrel shotgun from a closet and loaded it. He woke up Heidi and told her to flee from the house and go to the detached garage. He claimed that this was their safety plan, which had been worked out in advance. As they were making their way through the house, Heidi grabbed her wallet from a table next to the front door. At this moment, a black man wearing a dark hooded sweatshirt made entry into the house. The intruder grabbed the barrel of the shotgun and wrestled with Nick. Nick's finger slipped onto the trigger and the gun discharged. Heidi was shot and went straight to the floor. Nick and the intruder continued to wrestle. The shotgun discharged for a second time, striking Nick in the leg. At this point, the intruder fled. The police found Nick's story hard to believe and wanted to speak with him again, but he retained an attorney. Of course, he was advised that there would be no more talking to the police. Nick went on with his life as the investigation into his wife's murder stalled. He found a new romantic partner. Her name was Rachel. They married in August 2012. The couple did not have good credit, but they were able to move into a house with the help of family members. Over time, Nick and Rachel grew apart. According to Rachel, Nick lied to her about small topics, including how he was spending money. After discovering a notice indicating that the property taxes were delinquent on the house, Rachel took the children and left. Apparently, Nick had hidden the notice in a sock drawer. The couple divorced in 2018. As all this was happening, the police had developed a renewed interest in the case. They determined that Nick must have killed his first wife, Heidi.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident?
That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
In 2021, Nick was arrested and charged with first-degree and second-degree murder. On February 10, 2023, Nick was found guilty of both charges. On April 13, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now moving to my analysis. Nicholas Firkus maintains his innocence. He has many supporters who believe that he was not capable of committing murder. They insist that a mysterious intruder was the killer. This brings me to the question, was Nick responsible for Heidi's death? Let's take a look at the evidence both for and against the idea that Nick was guilty of murder, starting with the inculpatory factors. Nick's wife Heidi was shot in the back one time with his shotgun. Nick admits that his finger pulled the trigger, although he said this was the result of a fight with an intruder. Nick's description of what happened doesn't make any sense. He would have people believe that this mysterious intruder, who no one else saw, just happened to break into the house as he and his wife were near the front door on their way to another door. The intruder fights with Nick in such a way that Nick's finger pulled the trigger of the double-barrel shotgun not once, but twice. Amazingly, both times happened to strike human beings. Heidi is fatally shot in the back while Nick escapes with just a minor wound. In Nick's house, there was no DNA from anyone that could have been the intruder. This is true for the shotgun as well. During the call that Heidi made to 911, there was no significant background noise before the apparent shotgun blast. Heidi did not say anything that would suggest the intruder had made entry into the house. How did the intruder break in the front door and struggle with Nick without making any noise? During Nick's 911 call, the police can be heard arriving, so clearly background noise was audible over the phone. This makes it seem like Nick was standing there with the shotgun telling Heidi that someone was at the door. When she turned around, he simply shot her in the back. Based on Nick's story, the intruder would have probably made contact with a table in the foyer, but nothing on that table was disturbed. Tests performed by the police indicated that, from his bedroom, Nick could not have heard someone manipulating the doorknob on the front door. Nick said that he had just moved the shotgun upstairs from the basement about a month earlier, not based on a fear about a break-in, rather because the shotgun was rusting. This seems awfully convenient that he just happened to move the shotgun that close to the murder. Nick said that when he and Heidi were walking downstairs to escape the house, she was in front of him, even though he was carrying the shotgun. Nick and Heidi were in a terrible financial position. They were going to be evicted the day after the murder, and they had over $17,000 of debt on one credit card alone. Nick claimed that Heidi was aware of their grave financial situation. They were both embarrassed, and that's why they kept the information hidden from family and friends. They were trying to get through this together. This is hard to believe. There is quite a bit of evidence that Heidi was unaware of what was happening. A few examples. Nick and Heidi exchanged emails in March and April of 2010. Heidi repeatedly asked Nick to handle phone calls that she was getting from creditors. Nick assured Heidi that the situation was under control. The problem was that they had been victimized by fraud on their bank account. The bank said that there had been no fraud. Heidi never told any of her friends or relatives about a foreclosure, an eviction, or needing a place to stay. A law firm handling the foreclosure never had any contact with Heidi. There was no documented communication whatsoever between Nick and Heidi regarding foreclosure or eviction. Not one discussion about moving out. On the day of the murder, there wasn't much packed in the house, like they didn't appear to be ready to move. Yet Nick and Heidi were supposed to be moving out the next day. Heidi had texted a friend and made plans to get a pedicure during the afternoon of Sunday, April 25. And Heidi was scheduled to work on Monday, April 26. She did not take the day off. 2 days after the eviction hearing that Nick attended alone, Nick and Heidi visited an apartment complex and looked at two apartments. The rent for one of them was about $1,400. The rent for the other was $2,200. Heidi told the rental agent that she wanted to sell her house and move to the city. In reality, the house had already been foreclosed and sold at auction. One day after this apartment hunting episode, Heidi sent an email to a friend saying, quote, "Wish we weren't tied down to our house so we could move somewhere fun," unquote. Through email, Nick had communicated to Heidi that they had an appointment to talk to a real estate agent on Monday, April 26, the day after the murder. That agent said he hadn't spoken to Nick in over a year. There was no meeting scheduled for April 26. Nick had a history of deception even outside of his communication with Heidi. For example, he told the law firm handling the foreclosure that his grandmother was in hospice. In reality, neither of his grandmothers were in hospice, and neither died in 2010. Moving to the exculpatory factors, there were no witnesses to the murder, no video. There were marks on the door frame as if somebody had tried to force entry. None of the screwdrivers that Nick had access to matched those marks. If the intruder was wearing gloves, as Nick claimed, it stands to reason that they would not have left DNA behind. If Nick was embarrassed about his financial situation, staging a murder was not going to help keep it a secret. As far as Nick walking behind his wife as they were trying to escape the house, maybe he was using her as a human shield. Nick was a coward. Based on his history, it is difficult to argue with that assertion. As far as Heidi failing to mention how they were moving, maybe Nick was planning on doing all the work himself. When considering all the evidence, do I think that Nick Firkus was guilty? Yes. I think he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's astonishing that the police ever believed his story, even a little bit. It was painfully obvious from the very beginning that Nick was the killer. This was not a case that should have taken years to prosecute. Moving to the last question, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. Nicholas Firkus appears to have extremely low conscientiousness. He never met a bill that he could pay on time. Nick had the habit of running up debt and disregarding any reminders of reality, like credit card statements. He lived in his own fantasy world where carelessness would never be penalized. Nick was embarrassed about his prodigal behavior. He did not want his wife Heidi to find out. He did not want her opinion of him to be reduced. For whatever reason, this was a central motivator in his life. Over time, his low conscientiousness and his fear of embarrassment were two forces that battled with each other, but the former was always the victor. Nick knew what he needed to do to get out of debt, but he always said to himself, "I'll give myself one more day of fun." Ultimately, Nick ran out of days. Facing eviction and the resulting inevitable humiliation, Nick killed his wife for the sake of protecting his feelings. He did not really care about how his wife would feel. It was all about Nick. He did it because he was self-centered, had a sense of entitlement, had a lack of empathy, and was full of shame. In keeping with his pattern of concealing information from Heidi, he shot her in the back after telling her that an intruder was trying to get into their house. Even at the moment of her death, she was unaware of her husband's depravity. She died thinking that he was protecting her. Now moving to my final thoughts. I think there are two major lessons in this case. One, it can be hazardous to completely trust a spouse. A little bit of suspicion can offer a lot of protection. Two, extremely low conscientiousness can be pernicious. Nick was able to get away, at least initially, with killing his first wife, and yet fell back into the same pattern of lying about money with his second wife. Personality traits do not tend to change much over time. At one point prior to Nick's arrest, he was having a conversation with Heidi's parents about the killer when he said, "They will never find him." Based on the fact that he was the killer, I guess one could say that Nick's pessimism was overly optimistic. Spending his life in prison will be one bill for which Nick will not be delinquent.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic. And now each week, I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcasts, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.